Hello, I'm Troy Abels from Hanford, California, and you are listening to Gospel Tangents.
It's the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. It took 18 long years to bring John D. Lee to trial. Why did it take so long? Historian Will Bagley says there was a cover-up. Is that true? We'll talk about more about that, so you won't want to miss this. Check out our conversation. I also want to remind you that I'm going to be giving away a book written by Will Bagley called The Wise Want Everything. This is one of your last chances to win, so sign up at gospeltangents.com/Bagley if you'd like a chance to win this autographed book. So sign up today. Now back to our conversation. All right, so we just finished talking about the September 29th meeting with John D. Lee and the apostles and Brigham Young. So
September 30th. It's two meetings.
Oh, there's two meetings.
It's one on Friday. No, it's not Friday. I don't know what day it is. But it's...
say Monday, so... Yeah, I don't know what day that is either.
But... what I'm saying is that the event that Wilford Woodruff records is staged. And in Lee's account... which is, of course, untrustworthy. Brigham Young tells him, "Don't even tell Heber about this," which is a tribute to Heber C. Kimball.
Okay.
But we're now dealing with the cover-up, which begins in 1857, and for my money, is still going on.
Okay.
But it's often not the crime that gets criminals in trouble. It's the cover-up. And in some ways I find the Mountain Meadows cover-up very revealing. But it has its casualties, because a lot of the men who got swept up in this and were involved in murdering people are traumatized. It's easy for us as American civilians to not appreciate how traumatic it is and how difficult it is to kill somebody. If you're going to kill 120 men, women, and children, it's going to be a nasty, revolting, unforgettable experience. And especially since most of these people were not adult males, they were women and children. Now, how did they get these decent Christian men to do this? That's one of the questions that's haunted me in all the 30 years I've dealt with Mountain Meadows. How do you persuade people to do such horrific crimes? And I have a whole lot of Mormon ancestors. In fact, all my ancestors are Mormons, and I understand what they sacrificed and how much they were willing to sacrifice. But I can't believe any of them would have engaged in something like this. But Voltaire said, "Men who can make people believe in absurdities can make people believe in, can make people commit atrocities." Voltaire said, "Men who can make people believe absurdities can make people commit atrocities." And if you're going to believe something like blood atonement, that's an absurdity. And the atrocity plays out in Mountain Meadows, and is still the most aggravating cancer on the Mormon Church. And no matter how much money they spend, they're never going to get past that as a problem. But there is so much of the cover-up that I find despicable. And for instance, the quote-unquote investigations. And we have detailed accounts of the conspiracy that was mounted against Mormon leaders to deceive them. And these are absurd notions. Who does Brigham Young send down to southern Utah to investigate what caused the Mountain Meadows Massacre? George A. Smith! What better guy? It'd be like sending Dick Cheney to investigate what happened in Iraq. But they actually visit the Meadows and they come up with a likely scapegoat. Because at the end of one of Smith's letters, he says, "And we don't really know what John D. Lee was up to, but he seems to have been involved in this somehow." So they already know who they're going to eventually hang it on. And why did they pick John D. Lee? Because the other two guys are untouchable. The other two guys, senior officers, are William Dame and Isaac Haight. Now, in the church's tale, they say, well, once Brigham Young realized what was happening in 1870, he excommunicated the main murderers. No, he didn't. He didn't excommunicate Dame. He didn't excommunicate. He did excommunicate Haight.
Well, wasn't the problem with Lee was he just wouldn't shut up, whereas the other guys were quiet about it?
Yeah. And Rick Turley makes the point that Lee talked about it, which he did. He couldn't help himself. He was that kind of a guy. And he apparently goes back to his fort at Harmony and tells them all how he had a dream about this massacre and what happened. So he's already talking. They've allegedly sworn an oath of silence, but you can't help but talk about this. Who's the guy who has an iron lock on the church's protection? And I think this is a good way of identifying who can you really hang the blame on here. Well, William Dame. Dame isn't at the massacre, neither is Isaac Haight. But they're only relieved of being stake presidents. No, Haight is relieved of being stake president in 1859. But Dame isn't. Dame is stake president till he dies, practically. And my notion is that these guys have something on Brigham Young. And what it is direct orders. Lee never got direct orders. He got George A. Smith's a wink and a nod and what would happen if, and the mafioso approach that Smith took with Lee. But during the Lee trials, one of Isaac Haight's wives says, my husband has orders that might not exonerate him, but would definitely put the saddle on a different horse. And Dame allegedly, during one of their hearings about what are we going to do about this, says, if you try to blame this on me, I'll put the saddle on the right horse. And the right horse is George A. Smith. But so, in 1874, Isaac Haight has been excommunicated. And during one of Brigham Young's winters in St. George, Haight goes down and has a long conversation with his old pal Brigham Young. And what happens? He gets baptized and reinstituted in the church. Now, what do you suppose they talked about? Do you think it could have been, well, maybe he did have these orders and he could have gone up, flipped over to the Federals and helped convict Brigham Young of involvement in the Mountain Meadows Massacre? Well, he sure could have. Which is why Lee is the perfect scapegoat. Because he's only got, according to his own account, the wink and the nod approach. But so, in some ways, as I said to Bill Slaughter, the first part of setting up the massacre and all that, that's fairly easy to dodge because you've got the Herbert Howe Bancroft outline on how to do it. But the cover-up is undeniable. And I want to read what Juanita Brooks said about that.
Okay.
Brigham Young was not a credulous simpleton. He was not duped or hoodwinked. He was not misinformed. He knew the true story of the Mount Meadows Massacre, about which the most damning reports were soon published in the Gentile world and widely circulated even among the Mormons themselves, as well as any man in Utah. And he also knew the names of the individual Mormons, whether prominent or obscure, who participated in the wholesale atrocities. John D. Lee was one of those participants. But, oh yes. That's one of my favorite lines. And I'm sure the Lee journals are credited to both her and Robert Cleland, but Cleland was beyond writing by the time he got around to allegedly co-writing that book. But Brigham Young was not a simpleton, and he was not easily fooled. And that's another reason I believe Lee knew better than to lie to Brigham Young. But so it goes. And then we get to the trial.
Okay, good.
And
this is the first trial.
Yeah, the first trial, which, as I said, is fairly predictable because it's a mixed jury. And at the end of the day, after a trial that lasts almost 2 weeks, and is prosecuted by a character named Robert Baskin. He's acting U.S. attorney. And Baskin writes a great book called Reminiscences of Early Utah. And he runs down the Mountain Meadows Massacre in very good detail. And he was, of course, involved in it and makes all the Mormons just madder than hell who attend the trial. But he gets a hung jury, and it's the Mormons voting not guilty, and the non-Mormons all vote guilty.
Do we know how many non-Mormons were on the Mormons and non-Mormons were on the jury pool?
I think there were three.
Three non-Mormons. And nine Mormons So the three non-Mormons vote to convict, the nine Mormons vote not guilty.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm not quite sure on, maybe I've got that reversed. But as the second trial begins, there's a new federal attorney. His name is Sumner Howard. And I missed a critical piece of information, and I was still baffled by what was Sumner Howard up to. And I suspected he was bribed, straight up. But he explains what he does in a letter written shortly after Lee was executed that's published in the New York Herald. And as he starts out, he says, Brigham Young was not a fool. And if you believe that any written evidence linking him to the Mountain Meadows Massacre was still around after 6 months, you're crazy. But it's pretty clear that the record that we have has been pretty well cleaned up. And when the church announced their major project on Mountain Meadows in 2002, they said they hoped to find some contemporary new accounts of Mountain Meadows. They didn't find any. What they found in all their research was a record of where I'd done research and a bunch of stuff that they'd hidden from themselves that were in the first presidency's vaults. And that's what they, what Walker largely relied on in Massacre at Mountain Meadows. But I'd seen selections from that material, and it's all junk, because they're confessions by guys who are lying, and nobody wants to admit what they were doing. We have several confessions by Nephi Johnson, who comes across as a sympathetic figure who wrestles with the legacy of the Mountain Meadows for the rest of his life, and dies screaming on his deathbed, "Blood, blood, blood." And in the Mormon story, Nephi Johnson watched the Indians kill the women and children.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with historian Will Backley. In our next conversation, Will is going to ask and then answer the most important question of Mountain Meadows.
Why am I so sure that Brigham Young ordered the massacre? Because he confessed to it. Now, that will certainly surprise a lot of faithful Mormons, but let me look at here's what I wrote about it.
For those of you who are interested in the entire interview uncut without any interruptions, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview for just $5 a month. Also, we have other tiers. If you'd like to subscribe on our website at gospeltangents.com, click on the yellow subscribe button and you can subscribe for $10. You can also do that on Patreon and get a PDF transcript. We've also got some other ones for $15 and $20 if you'd like to get those as well. If you're interested in individual transcripts, go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview, and you can see our past interviews there in paperback form. So just check out Gospel Tangents. We're always updating those. For the latest updates on Facebook, go to Facebook.com/Gospel Tangents and you can see our latest updates there. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. Of course, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And please give us a 5-star rating for those of you who listen to audio only. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.